Vikatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Vikatra AI. Welcome, everyone. Today, we are jumping into a really significant book, All the President's Men, by Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward. For a lot of us, I think the title itself just is Watergate.
It really is synonymous, yeah. But, you know, thinking of it just as a history lesson kind of misses the point, I think.
Yeah.
Our goal here is to look at it as, well, almost like a procedural manual.
A procedural? How so?
Well, it demonstrates so powerfully the role of a free press, right? Mm-hmm. The Fourth Estate in action. It shows, like, step by painstaking step, mm-hmm. how these two reporters, who didn't have much besides sheer grit, uncovered this massive criminal conspiracy.
And it started, at the very top.
Exactly. Orchestrated right from the White House.
What strikes me reading it again is how it focuses on the how. The process, not just the political fallout. We forget it kicked off with what the administration called a, quote, third-rate burglary.
Right. Dismissed it completely.
And the genius of the book, I think, is showing how that one seemingly small event unraveled this huge, dangerous abuse of power. It's like watching the checks and balances system actually work, but under immense pressure.
It really is. It flips the script, you know? Instead of focusing on the politicians, you're following the reporters, the shoe leather reporting. And you realize the investigation itself was the big gamble.
So who were these guys? Bernstein and Woodward? They're pretty young, weren't they? Working the Metro desk at the Washington Post back in 72. Not exactly household names then.
Not at all.
Yeah.
And they had very different styles, which, interestingly, probably made the partnership work so well. You had Woodward.
Yeah.
Bob Woodward, Yale grad, former naval intelligence officer.
Right, the more buttoned-down one.
You could say that. Very analytical, disciplined, relentless in his methods.
Mm-hmm.
Great at cultivating sources, cross-referencing everything. But he'd only been at the Post for like 9 months.
Wow, only 9 months. And Bernstein?
Carl Bernstein, yeah. Almost the opposite. College dropout, started as a copy boy at 16. More flamboyant, maybe? Known for his street smarts, his sheer tenacity. Like, he'd literally wait for hours on someone's doorstep.
Yeah, you get that sense from the book.
And he was brilliant at pulling together complex threads into a clear story. He brought that sort of aggressive energy.
So the insider and the outsider working together.
Pretty much. Woodward the stoic, Bernstein the passionate one. You'd think maybe egos would clash, right? But they really needed each other's skills to tackle this incredibly layered story.
And the look itself isn't just about the investigation.
No, that's the thing. It is the investigation, told from their perspective. It's their story. They lived it.
Okay, let's talk about the book itself. It's nonfiction, obviously, but it reads like a thriller novel, doesn't it?
Totally. Like a detective story.
Yeah.
And that's intentional. It's not aiming for, like, high-level political theory. It wants to pull you, the reader, right down into the trenches, the day-to-day grind.
So it starts June 17th, 1972. The break-in at the Democratic National Committee offices. Watergate building.
Yep. Bang. Yep. Right into the action.
Yeah.
Five guys arrested. And the book just follows Woodward and Bernstein as they start tugging on those first threads, linking the burglars to the CIA, and then the really big one.
Creep. The committee to reelect the president.
Exactly.
Right.
Creep. That link changed everything.
And the book just dives into the real nitty-gritty of reporting, doesn't it? The endless phone calls, digging through records, trying to convince scared people to talk.
Oh, absolutely. The shoe leather reporting, as they say. But also gives you this amazing look inside the Washington Post itself, the pressure they were under.
That's a huge part of the drama. You see the publisher, Katherine Graham, and the editor, Ben Bradley, making these incredibly tough calls.
Yeah, deciding whether to trust these two young reporters, whether to run these stories based on anonymous sources, Deep Throat being the most famous, obviously.
Deep Throat, yeah. We'll get to him.
But they were risking everything, you know, the paper's reputation, its finances, potentially legal challenges from the White House. They really went all in.
It's important to note where the book ends, too. May 1973. It doesn't cover Nixon's resignation.
Right. It stops basically when their investigation forces the appointment of a special prosecutor and the Senate hearings begin. They'd laid the groundwork. The legal system could take it from there.
It built the foundation for the collapse.
Pretty much. So let's walk through how they did it, phase by phase.
Yeah.
Because that's where you really see the method.
Okay, phase one, that third-rate burglary, Woodward's covering the arraignment, and right away things seem off.
Yeah, anomalies everywhere. Why were these guys dressed so well? Why did they have $100 bills
mm-hmm.
all in sequence? And one of them, James McCord, former CIA.
Doesn't sound very third rate.
Exactly. The official story just didn't add up.
And then the first huge break, Woodward finds E. Howard Hunt's name. Where was it? An address book.
Yep, in one of the burglar's address books.
Yeah.
And next to it, the letters WH, White House.
So he calls the White House switchboard.
And gets connected straight to Charles Colson's office, a top Nixon aide. Boom. Suddenly, this local crime story is knocking on the Oval Office door.
And then they confirm McCord works for CREEP as head of security.
Right, which directly contradicts the White House denials. They had to be covering something up, which leads straight into phase two.
Ah, the famous advice.
You got it. Follow the money. Deep Throat's guidance. That shifted everything away from political spin towards hard, traceable evidence.
So they zeroed in on this one check, right? $25,000.
A $25,000 cashier's check.
Yeah.
Started at a Republican fundraiser. They had to trace it back meticulously through layers of bank accounts, shell corporations, all the way to a secret slush fund at TREEP.
Wow. And that was the smoking gun.
Pretty much. It directly linked campaign money to paying for this criminal activity.
But finding the paper trail is one thing. They needed people to talk, didn't they?
Absolutely. And that took courage from the sources. Hugh Sloan Jr., the former CREEP treasurer, was key here. He confirmed that top White House guys, like H.R. Haldeman, Nixon's chief of staff, knew about this fund and were controlling it, covering it up.
Sloan's testimony must have been terrifying for him.
Immensely risky. He essentially corroborated the money trail with human testimony. And finding out about this fund, this centrally managed pot of money, it led them into phase three.
Right, the Dirty Tricks campaign. This is where it gets even wilder.
Yeah, because the break-in wasn't isolated. They uncovered this whole parallel operation, a nationwide campaign of sabotage and spying against Democratic candidates, especially Senator Muskie.
Muskie was seen as the main threat to Nixon.
He was, early on. So they went after him hard. They identified this guy, Donald Segretti, as a key operative, forging letters, spreading rumors, disrupting campaign events.
That infamous Canuck letter story came from this, right?
Exactly. A forged letter implying Muskie insulted French Canadians. It hit him hard in the New Hampshire primary. He got emotional defending his wife in public.
And it damaged his image, made him look unstable.
It was brutal psychological warfare. And here's the kicker. How did they connect the dirty tricks back to the break-in?
Let me guess. The money.
Bingo. Segretti's payments came from the exact same secret creepy slush fund. It proved this wasn't random freelancers. It was a coordinated strategy, controlled from the top.
But, and this is the frustrating part in the book, they publish all this huge stuff before the 1972 election.
And Nixon wins anyway, in a landslide.
Yeah, the public just didn't buy it or didn't care yet.
Hard to say. Maybe it was too complex, too unbelievable. But after the election, the story went cold for a bit. Pressure mounted on the Post. And this is where Deep Throat becomes really crucial again. Phase four.
So Deep Throat wasn't necessarily giving them new scoops at this point.
Not always brand new leads, no. It was more strategic. Woodward would meet him, you know, in that famous parking garage.
Shadowy meetings.
Right. But it was often to confirm things they already suspected, to get context. Deep Throat confirmed the cover-up itself was the real story, and that it went all the way up.
All the way.
And crucially, he warned Woodward their lives might be in danger. That gave the editors, Bradley and Graham, the resolve to keep pushing, even with all the denials and attacks coming from the White House.
That confirmation must have been vital, just knowing they were on the right track.
Absolutely. It was a lifeline. And that relentless pressure, combined with Judge Sirica leaning on the burglars during sentencing, that finally cracked it open. Phase five.
Judge Sirica, he really pushed them.
He did. And James McCord, facing a long sentence, finally broke. He wrote that letter to Sirica claiming others had perjured themselves, that there was political pressure to stay quiet.
And once one person flipped,
the whole house of cards started to wobble. Then John Dean, the president's own lawyer, realized he was probably being set up as the fall guy.
So he decided to cooperate.
He decided to tell investigators everything he knew. That was the final dam breaking. Led directly to Haldeman and Ehrlichman resigning. The path to Nixon's downfall was clear.
Just an incredible chain of events driven by reporting.
It really is. So, stepping back from the sheer drama of it all, what are the big themes, the takeaways that still matter today?
Well, number one has to be the power and responsibility of the press. The book is like Exhibit A for the press as the Fourth Estate, holding power accountable.
But it's not just about power, right? It's about the responsibility that comes with it.
Exactly. Their power only worked because they were obsessed with accuracy. They had to be unshakably correct, and they needed the courage institutionally and personally to withstand incredible intimidation. That power is fragile.
Very true. Okay, second theme, persistence and method. This wasn't about one lucky break. It was grinding, methodical work.
Shoe leather reporting, checking facts, then checking them again. The two-source rule. Making call after call, it really shows that steady, incremental effort often wins out over, you know, flashes of brilliance. Stick to the process.
Now, the sheer doggedness is amazing. Third.
Has to be the importance of sources. None of this happens without people like Hugh Sloan taking huge risks or Deep Throat providing that crucial, albeit anonymous, guidance.
Right. It underscores the vital need for journalists to build trust and protect people who step forward with the truth, often at great personal cost. Without that trust, investigative journalism just collapses.
Definitely. And a final theme, maybe.
I think it's the banality of the cover-up. It's fascinating how the cover-up, not the initial crime, is what ultimately destroyed Nixon's presidency.
It just kept escalating, didn't it? One lie needing another lie.
Driven by panic, misplaced loyalty, fear. It shows how attempts to bury the truth almost always implode. The cover-up becomes way more damaging than whatever they were trying to hide in the first place.
A lesson for the ages, really. You know, the book also gave us some phrases that are just part of the language now.
Oh, for sure. Let's talk about a few. The most famous has to be...
Follow the money.
Yep. Simple, direct, powerful. It wasn't just advice. It was a strategy. Forget the political noise. Trace the cash. It's still fundamental to investigations today, right? Financial trails don't lie easily.
So true. And then there was that White House tactic, the non-denial denial.
Ah, yes. Masters of evasion. They often couldn't deny the specific facts Woodward and Bernstein were reporting because, well, they were true.
Right.
So instead, they'd attack the reporters, question their motives, call it shabby journalism, character assassination, anything to muddy the waters and undermine credibility without actually refuting the substance.
Classic deflection. We still see that kind of thing today.
Constantly. Another key idea was that moment of realization for the reporters.
That this wasn't just about the break-in.
Exactly. Realizing they were uncovering, quote, a whole covert operation. It shifted the scale entirely. This wasn't just a burglary. It was a systemic attack on the democratic process itself.
Mind-blowing. And finally, the constant pressure from their editor, Ben Bradley.
About getting it right.
Yeah.
Always getting it right. Bradley knew their only weapon against the power of the presidency was absolute credibility. One mistake, one factual error they could pounce on, and the whole thing could have been discredited.
The stakes were unbelievably high. Okay, so bringing this into our lives today, how can someone listening apply these lessons, professionally maybe?
Well, that follow the evidence idea works anywhere, doesn't it? Managing a project, doing research, even just figuring out a problem at work. Don't get sidetracked by office politics or emotional arguments. Look at the data. Follow the trail.
Like a forensic approach to business.
Sort of, yeah. And it's a huge lesson in professional integrity. Resisting pressure to bury bad news or uncomfortable truths. The book shows pretty clearly the cover-up is usually worse.
That point about sources, too. I was thinking about mentorship. Deep Throat didn't give Woodward the answers, but he confirmed if he was on the right path, warned him of dangers. Good managers can do that, right? Build trust so people feel safe bringing concerns forward.
That's a great analogy. Creating that culture of transparency where people aren't afraid to speak up rather than one based on fear and loyalty tests like in the Nixon White House, that's crucial for any healthy organization.
And for all of us, just as citizens.
It's a masterclass in media literacy, isn't it? Understanding the sheer hard work and verification, the two-source rule, protecting sources, that goes into real investigative journalism helps you tell the difference between solid reporting and just noise or rumor. It helps you know what to value.
Absolutely. So, final thoughts. What really stays with you from this book?
For me, it's the sheer audacity of it all. The transformation of this huge political mess into a story about the craft of journalism. How two determined people, armed with facts and maybe a bit of naivete at the start, could actually challenge the most powerful office on earth, but only because they were relentlessly committed to the truth.
Yeah, my takeaway is similar. It's that realization that democracy and accountability aren't automatic. They don't just happen. They require people, reporters, sources, editors, citizens, to actively, and sometimes bravely, pursue the truth, even when it's hard, even when it's unpopular. It's a timeless defense of transparency and really the First Amendment.
Couldn't agree more. It's a vital story.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.